Hello and welcome to the Rambling Runner Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Chittum. This is the podcast for all the dedicated amateur runners out there who are working hard to get better while balancing running with the rest of their lives. And this show is presented, as always, by ASICS. Have you checked out ASICS.com today? I'll tell you what, I did. And I was actually met by a surprise. There's a brand new Nimbus out right now, and it's 100% made to be recycled. It's an incredible thing. Once you're done with the shoe, you basically send it back to ASICS. It's this whole process where the entire shoe, not only is it made out of recyclable material and the Flight Foam Blast Plus Eco is made out of a lot of recycled material, but the shoe itself can be recycled. It's an insane thing. It really is amazing. The Nimbus 26 is one of the best easy day recovery shoes on the market. It's just fantastic for those easy days that you really want to get just to baby the legs a little bit. And this shoe is basically a recycled or to be recycled version of that. We've seen some smaller brands do this sort of thing, but never a brand like ASICS. It's at the top of their game and doing it with one of their elite shoes. So go check it out at ASICS.com today. Today's episode is with Katie Arnold. Katie is one of the best trail and ultra runners in the world. She's won the Leadville 100. She's podiumed at a lot of races. She's absolutely fantastic. In addition to that, she's one of the best writers that we have in the running space. She was on the show a couple of years ago for her book, Running Home, which is one of the best books I've ever read. And she is back. She has a new book coming out tomorrow. That's right, April 16th. So we're going to talk about that book, her running, and the process by which someone goes about writing about their life, especially when some of the people in the book are still in their life, especially a book like this, which is kind of like a getting in the nitty gritty of all things. And this is really a remarkable book. It's about running, but it's also not about running in some ways. It's just phenomenal. Katie's a wonderful person and a truly remarkable writer. So let's get into it with Katie Arnold. All right, Katie Arnold is back on the podcast, one of my favorite writers, out with a new book coming out very shortly, Brief Flashings in the Phenomenal World. Katie, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Matt. It's great to be here.
Oh, I'm so glad that you could be on the show. Last time you were on, that was one of my favorite podcasts. Kind of during that era, I loved your first book. It was really, really well done. And just like this book, certainly it's about your life. And as someone who is an avid runner and a very good runner at that, there's a lot of running in it, but it isn't inherently about running or solely about running. That is for sure. So this book is very similar. Again, like I said to you before we got going, it's kind of hard because I don't want to be like, here's the book in 30 yeah. minutes. No need to buy it anymore.
Right.
but at the same time, I think the one part that was interesting to me, I told you this offline, I had to keep reminding myself, like, oh my God, all this stuff was happening the last time I talked to Katie Arnold. But, as you mentioned, like, there's this lag time between the books. So it's like, oh yeah, hold on. I think I talked to her like around this time.
Yeah.
The whole thing is wild. When you go back and kind of revisit these eras, how much of it is like trying to remember what happened versus like you have all of these moleskin notebooks that you talk about in the book, kind of writing all this stuff down as you go because you love to journal and all of that. How much of it like is the symbiosis of the two, and how much do you need like time to kind of reflect what that era was that happened the 2, 3, 4 years prior?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do need time as a writer to digest what happened. And I think just as a human being, right, when we're in the midst of something, whether it's something amazing or traumatic, or in the case of what I write about in Brief Flashings in the Phenomenal World, both, right? When you're in it, you are so immersed in it that it's hard to have that perspective and that time and distance on it to sort of understand and process and see what the story is. And so the events that I write about in Brief Flashings in the Phenomenal World, which really begins with this traumatic wilderness accident on the Middle Fork of the Salmon River in 2016, and kind of ends more or less like after the finish of Leadville in 2018, I didn't start writing the book until early in the pandemic. And though I knew as it was happening that, like any writer, you know when you have material that's good. And although, as I said to, I think it was my editor at the time for Running Home, I was like, she said, oh, this is great material for for your next book. And I was like, yeah, I just wish it weren't my material. Right. And so, you know, as it's happening, these events, and you're sort of witnessing your life as like, and your character in your life, and you see it happening, you know, it's a story. But you need time to, away from the story to see kind of its shape, if that makes sense. So yeah, I had about 2 years after winning Leadville before I really started writing this book about kind of that whole experience, which again, Leadville was part of it, but it's, as you alluded to, it's much bigger than a story about running.
Yeah, and it's not like people weren't asking you about that victory, like before we even were writing this book, right? People like me asking you questions like, hey, how was, tell me about the race. Tell me about the buildup. Tell me about overcoming the broken leg, right? All of this stuff. Like, it's not as if you were siloed from the world and all of this was kind of marinating in your life. Like, you were living it, you know, I'm going to say living it out loud, but this was public knowledge for a long time before it ended up on the page.
Correct. And I think what the interesting part in the way the sort of life cycle of a book works is, like, I was talking about running home at the time, and that book was itself a story about grief and transformation and healing. And then sort of the, you know, the Leadville story was like a footnote or an afterthought to that book. And so as a writer, though, there's so much that I wanted to explore with kind of how, you know, how one transforms from this devastating injury. And really, it's about learning, like, how I realized that I was going to have to train my mind and use my mind to heal my body. And so that just takes time to understand how that worked and kind of what the process was in basically retraining myself and reinventing my relationship with running.
Right, because it is interesting when you use the word reinvention, because even in your first book and how you talk about running, and you reference this many times in Phenomenal World, and even your daughter makes reference of it, is like the idea of running wild. And living like that, and being wild in the wilderness, and phrases like that pop up in both books. So when you say it's a reinvention with how you approach running, and from afar, it doesn't seem like it's that far connected. Yeah. Can you, as someone who actually lived the experience, talk about the differences between the two?
Yeah, I think I've always been a runner my whole life, and I've always been, I think, a different sort of runner in that competition was not at the forefront of why I ran. I think I always sought motion and running and being outside as a way of telling stories. And so it's part of my creative process to move and run. And so that, you're right, has always been the baseline. But in my late 30s and early 40s, when I started running and competing, it's really hard to keep that balance, right? And it's so easy, especially in our social media world where everyone is sort of, you know, you're trying to keep up with everyone on social media and what are other runners doing. It's really easy to get pulled out of your original self and put the focus on the competition and the racing, and everyone's got their race schedule lined up like a whole year in advance. And, you know, everyone's on Strava, not me. And, you know, like, there's tick lists, and I admire that. But for me, it was really easy to get pulled out of myself and to lose the original spark of why I run, which is really to tell stories. And so I knew I had to be very careful keeping that balance. But the more success you have, you know, in races, the harder it is to sort of reel yourself in and not get caught up in that culture. And so I, you know, in the year or so leading up to my accident, I was certainly identifying more as a competitive runner, and the results mattered, and, you know, being recognized mattered, and all those things, right? Like, the ego likes to win and likes to perform well. And so I had kind of lost touch with running as it had always been for me, like a very personal endeavor. And so then when the accident happened and my doctor told me, you know, if I were you, I would never run again, you know, it's like, if that were a movie, that's like the sort of like doomsday music, like dun, 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 you know? And so it was uncertain if I would ever run again. And I knew that if I did run, I would have to, that I would never run the same as I had before the accident for a variety of reasons, not just for my body, but because it had sort of been this threshold crossing over and having that accident wakes you up to like, you cannot take it for granted, your physical self and your able body. And so I didn't know if I would run again, but I knew that if I did, it would have to change dramatically. And I would have to kind of go back to the way I ran before, but also to go deeper into, you know, into a different way of looking at running, which is really like a creative expression and a way of being our truest self.
Right. And also when you have the ability to take something for granted, usually that's a good sign for that thing, right? It means that it's kind of moving at least semi-harmoniously through your life, or it's not notable insofar as you don't need to take note of its presence, right? So like, I feel like the same thing has happened to me many times with my injuries. Like, oh, I'm not gonna take running for granted again. It's like, well, you end up, you do. Because like, if you run for, say, every day for three straight months, it's like, oh, this is just part of my day. I'm not thinking about it. So it's not that you're even taking it for granted. It's just like, you can't just take note of every little thing.
Right.
Right. Like, by definition, you would just be awash in like constant emotions and stimulation.
Right. Exactly. I mean, running was really flowing for me, like during that period, right before my accident. Like, I was winning races. I felt amazing. I didn't think twice about going out for like a 5-hour run. So it was flowing, but there was like deeper internal friction, I think is the best way to put it. Like, I knew that something was at risk if I kept pursuing running as this kind of validation of my ego, as proof of identity, right? Like, we become so attached to labels as runners, like we're an ultra runner or, you know, whatever. And I knew that I had kind of gone, you know, fallen under that, where I really identified as an ultra runner and as an elite runner, or, you know, whatever your words are. And I was at risk of losing sort of like that very original joy that I got from running.
Yeah. And you did a great job in the first book talking about that. And there are parallel moments in this book where, especially running up the mountain and down the mountain, your house and all of those parallel tracks of like you running up that mountain. And it each time it made me so envious, not just of the area with which you run or in which you run, but also the way in which you do it, which I think is absolutely phenomenal. And you talked about how, like, you know, you don't align with like the whole, like, the stravification of running and really keeping it private. Again, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm on Strava. I have a healthy relationship with it. And I know a lot of other people do as well. Yeah. So it's not good or bad, but I really found it to be incredibly interesting. On a side note, are you able to do the same thing with your writing life? Like, do you disconnect from other writers and publications and the goings on in that world in a similar way that you do in the running world?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, I do. And I think that is so essential as both an athlete and an artist, is to kind of have it be internal, like to come from the inside and not the outside. And that said, you know, I am inspired by incredible running performances like Courtney, you know, and Jasmine just now at Barkley, like, and that inspiration feeds me as a runner. And so I need that because it keeps me wanting to push my boundaries and see what I'm capable of. So, you know, no shade on that. Like, I am very inspired, but I think the same with writing is that I do it. Like, when I write in my notebooks, as I mentioned, like I keep notebooks and I've always written in notebooks. They're kind of, I guess, a word for journals. I like notebooks better because they don't seem as precious. Like, I feel like you can write whatever you want in a notebook. Like, you could write a laundry list, you know, a grocery list, whatever. So writing in my notebook, you know, is how I keep my writing coming from within. And of course, I have to shift gears. Like when I'm writing for a publication, like if I've got an assignment with the New York Times or with Outside or the Wall Street Journal or whatnot, like that's different. I am, you know, writing something for an audience. But for the most part, when I write, I'm not thinking about what it will be or who it's for. I'm writing as close to the experience as I can and as truthfully as I can. And when I say truthfully, obviously, I don't just mean factually, but like capturing the essence of an experience. And so, yeah, I feel lucky that I have been able to kind of maintain that little bit of, it's like a bubble, like a protection in my writing and my running. Because I just think that you're more genuine and it's coming from a more truthful place when you're not just trying to keep up with what other people are doing. That said, I read a ton and I love, like reading is like my, you know, number one passion. And so I'm always reading and seeing what other people are doing and being amazed by it.
And it's interesting because these two major parts of your life outside of your family with the running side and the writing side, especially if we're talking about writing, I'm sorry, not in the book form, but say mm-hmm. like the freelance journalist mm-hmm. side of things, they seem to be like going in opposite directions, right? So you have like the, especially the sports media side, and I guess mm-hmm. we can broaden this out to all media, especially for the print side / digital, is that reading words is seemingly something that's gone down in terms yeah. of like, you know, journalistic value. Whereas on the ultra running side, it's like, never been more popular. It is booming, right? So yeah. What's it like been like for you to be in two arenas where the arrows are couldn't be more diverse?
Oh my gosh, that is the greatest question because I've never thought of it like that. But yeah, it kind of gives you whiplash. Maybe that's been my issue this whole time. I've been feeling like, what am I? Who? What am I doing? And like, how should a person be in the world, right? But you're right. Like journalism, I've been in the business for almost 30 years. I started when I was 2 years old. No, just kidding. But it's changed a lot. Like the value of the written word has gone way down, you know, like, and just in terms of sort of what your earning potential is as a writer, it's like a fraction of what it was. And publications are closing all the time. I'm dealing with that just now, like, you know, doing some publicity for Brief Flashings in the Phenomenal World. They're so far fewer print outlets than there used to be, even 5 years ago. So yeah, that's kind of contracting, collapsing even. And then you're right, ultras are like exploding and the distance keeps getting pushed. Now like 100 miles seems kind of ordinary. Is that sick? I mean, I feel like...
It is for me. I mean, 6 miles is still a lot for me.
Yeah, so. Actually, that's how I feel right now. I mean, I can't even imagine who does 100 miles. Anyway, but yeah, and so that's hard. Like when it's both are tricky, right? Like when something's contracting in your world that where you could make money and be valued as a journalist is shrinking, that's confusing and complicated. And then, but when something's just exploding too, it's the same thing. You're sort of disoriented of like, where do I fit in and what are my values in relationship to this, the world, the booming world of ultra running? And like, do I really, align with this urge to keep pushing farther and farther? Like now, like a 220 mile race is kind of normal, or not normal, but more and more people are doing it. And so both are kind of you know, there's like a disconcerting part of both of them. It's you just kind of, I think it comes back to you have to be really rooted in yourself and to know your values and to just act from that place. And so to not get pulled by either sort of, you know, extreme.
Right. I'd love to get your opinion on if it's a coincidence or if this was always going to be the natural byproduct of more and more people kind of being at home, being in front of screens, and then having this juxtaposition of wanting to then be out in the wild and mm-hmm. running farther and longer out in the wilderness or on trails, if that the boom in these at the same time isn't merely a contradiction, but ultimately it was going to happen that way because of one leading to the other.
Oh, it's like a causality. Whoa. Yeah, I think there's something to that. In that we are like human we're physical beings, right? Humans, we are animals. We need to move. We've always needed to move. Like, as you know, I'm a big believer in, if you have an artistic or even kind of entrepreneurial practice, like, you also need to have a physical practice, right? Like, the two go hand in hand. We need to move our bodies in order to move our minds and our imaginations. And so I think you're right. The more we are stationary indoor creatures, like screen bound animals, like, the more we really need to get outside. And I think we crave that movement and wildness, because we've become so tamed, I guess, for lack of a better word. I mean, I've always felt that myself, but I'm most at home outside and movement. And that's just this kind of my DNA going back to childhood. But I was talking to a woman the other day for another publication, and she was like telling me how extreme I am. And I was like, I actually feel like not that extreme. Like, I feel sort of ordinary extreme. And she couldn't wrap her mind around it. So I wonder if that's just the sort of ultra running or the running world. Like, now someone who has run 100 miles and that feels kind of just regular, right? Because the bar has been raised so high. I don't know. But it was just, it's interesting talking to someone who's not in the running world, right? She was interviewing me about my book, and you're like, maybe we are kind of nuts and we've lost sight of that. I don't know.
I love the phrase ordinary extreme. I feel like it should be a great like company or band name.
Yeah. Ordinary extreme. Maybe that's my new blog post, my new website or something. But yeah,
I feel like I'm the inverse of that right now. I'm the extreme ordinary at this point. But I thrive. I envision myself being ordinary extreme at some point.
Ordinary. Yeah, but maybe there's no difference between ordinary extreme and extreme ordinary.
Oh, there feels like there's an enormous difference.
You're asking the best questions. I love it. Yeah. So anyway, but it kind of messes with your mind, because you're like, I don't know, I've been doing this for so long, like, just who I am. And she even asked me, she was like, you know, why? Because I told her that I was going to ride the Leadville 100. And she's like, why do you think you keep pushing? And it was such an interesting, it's such an obvious question, but I think it's one that we in the endurance world and running worlds, like, don't ask ourselves, because it's just so obvious. It's like, we do this because it feeds us creatively, and, you know, and we want to see what our bodies are capable of. But more than our bodies, as I write about in Brief Flashings, it's our minds, right? It's really our minds that are going to carry us to the extreme. And so my answer for her was curiosity. Like, I'm just a curious person as a writer, as a human, as an athlete. I want to see, I want to experience it all. And so I think that was my answer. And that's why I keep doing these things, these ordinary extreme things.
Well, I think also part of it, let me tell you about your life, Katie Arnold. No, I think another part of it seems to be that you've tasted so many things at various points, because you have lived in a way that's been very outdoorsy ever since you were little. So, like, even riding, doing mountain bike, the Leadville 100, which, again, is not maybe a new endeavor for people listening to this podcast, which focuses on running, but that's been around for a while now as well. And, like, even that, like, you did that when you were younger. Like you talked about before, we were offline, like, this was a passion of yours decades ago. Yeah. So it's not like, hey, I'm trying, like, it's like, hey, I'm trying this new food, check it out. It's like, no, I tasted that a long time ago, man. Yeah. I just haven't been back to this restaurant in a while, but I love this place.
Yeah, I love this place. I love it. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think it's like, and I think that, you know, as we get older, right, like, we have a greater appreciation for all the layers within us, like all the, it's sort of like geologic layers, right? Like, there's the different rock layers within us of like, oh, that was me in my 20s. I was really big into mountain biking. And I have kind of a fondness for that 25-year-old me, right? And now that I'm like twice that age. And so, right, it's going back, to things that we used to do and loved and haven't done in a while because circumstances made us choose. You know, like my kids are older now, they're teenagers. I have more, a little bit more room in my life. Although it's interesting, I'm not really willing to travel for racing or as much because now I see the finish line with them, you know, not the finish line, but like they're going to be out of the house and I don't really want to miss anything. It's just kind of going back and revisiting all the people and girls and women I've been at various points in my life and wanting to explore new things, that may have been part of my life at an earlier time. But like you said, I haven't been back to, and, I think one of the big things is a draw for me is, and I write about this a lot in Brief Flashings in the Phenomenal World, is this idea of beginner's mind, which is an idea in Zen Buddhism of coming to something fresh, like dropping all preconceived notions of what it is or how to do it or your expertise. It's dropping your ego and coming in as a beginner. And you can do that with anything, something you've been doing your whole life, like running. You can approach each run with beginner's mind, which is like, oh, I don't know what I'm going to get today. And maybe yesterday I ran like a 6-minute mile, but I'm fresh today. Like I'm open to what is. And so I feel like I'm bringing beginner's mind to my mountain biking and to running too. Right? Like I'm a different runner than I was 3 or 4 years ago. Not better, not worse, just different. And so life is such a great opportunity. You can be a beginner with everything, every single day. It's really liberating.
Now, I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but it seems like you have made a point throughout your life of analyzing kind of where you are as a person and trying to expand on your knowledge base and being able to, you know, get the most out of yourself. Well, mm-hmm. not physically here, just more mentally, emotionally, yeah. Spiritually kind of thing. As a parent of two teenagers, how do you try to inculcate that same vibe in your kids while also allowing them the space to have the beginner's mind of their own without just like, I'm doing this because my mom told me I have to do it?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's like such a tricky balance. One of the greatest gifts that my parents gave me, and I write about this a little in Running Home, my first book, is that it was the 70s and they really didn't care what I did. You know, as long as I came home alive and more or less in one piece, though I was always getting into little dust ups and stuff, they were cool. And kids today live under the microscope, their own microscope, social media, their parents are trying to manage their sports careers and whatnot. And so I'm really mindful of kind of how I was raised, which was like I had a lot of room to find what I wanted to do and to do it. And no one really cared. And sometimes that felt a little like, hey, is anyone out there? Right. You know, that creates its own psychology. But my point is that I never felt pressured. And so I'm really careful not to pressure my girls. I mean, our main sort of parenting philosophy is to get them outside and raise them out as like, you know, humans in nature and have a relationship with the natural world so they can become stewards of the natural world and to try lots of different things. But I have to step back from their running. Like my older daughter is, you know, she was runner up state champion at cross country in the fall. And she's got her own thing with running. Like, I won't say, you know, the most I can say is maybe, you know, before the state meet, like maybe just drink a little extra water tonight. And she's like, Mom, I got it. Like, back off. You know, and
dare you, Katie Arnold? Yeah, who do you think you are?
She is so cool because she is so strong. Like, she has her system and she has this inner belief that I don't know that I've ever really had, where she has incredible composure in a race. I mean, once a race starts, I'm sort of in that mindset of like problem solving. I'm in the flow, like, let's do this. But she has this incredible inner strength that I love to see. So I don't want to mess with that. So she, you know, I step way back. I've just encouraged them to try lots of things and to like be alive in their bodies in the world.
Good for you. I feel like I missed like the critical period for that.
How old are your kids?
For some of my kids. Oh, they're 8 and 11. Yeah, it'll soon to be 8 and 11 anyway. My son's super active, my daughter not much, but yeah. Whether it's not a big deal here. But it's funny, it really does. Whenever I hear, or in this case read, about like your exploits, and especially in this book where like your kids are almost teenagers, or you mm-hmm. know, kind of at the precipice of being that, you talk about like how you're in certain ways homebound, not just because of the yeah. injury that you're dealing with, but also just the parenting part of it.
Yeah.
And the whole time I'm thinking, like, I wonder what happens next, even though, like, yeah. next, in this case, has already happened.
About
a book 6 hours, right. 6 years, you know,
yeah.
previous. But so when you're going back and you're doing interviews like this, or you're editing the book for the 10,000th time. Yeah.
Thank you.
Like, are you ever, like, go back and, I guess, look back on those years in a way that has, like, the judgment removed from it, or are you always like, oh my God, I can't believe this, or I can't believe that? Like, I imagine myself doing that constantly.
Do you think back, like, I do look back, enough time has passed that I do look back, and I sort of look back on the story that I am now telling in Brief Flashings about this crazy river accident and the aftermath and this like long healing period where it was uncertain if I would ever run again and if I would lose the thing that was not only central to me as an athlete, but really as an artist, as a writer. Most of my judgment has gone because just enough time has passed and I have compassion for the person I was then. But I will occasionally sort of, just even this morning, I was like, oh, I felt like I wish I hadn't carried anger as long as I did, and about the accident. And, you know, we haven't really talked about it, but this book is also very much like a love story. It's a story of a relationship and a marriage that, as we all know, is marriage is goes through ebbs and flows and tricky times and good times. And really kind of the accident on the river like plunged my marriage into sort of this, like, it upended it, just kind of as it upended our raft, and we fell, you know, I fell in the water and suffered this really bad injury. You know, our marriage didn't come away unscathed either. But, and so I will look back and be like, oh, I held on to that for so long, that anger. And of course, as I write about in the book, like, the anger was not just about the river accident. I think beneath that anger about what had happened was really sort of this anger about being a woman in the world and kind of what how we're expected to act as women and what marriage expects of us, and, you know, sort of the kind of older model of marriage felt like it was overlaid on top of my marriage with Steve. And we had always been very unconventional together, he and I, and that's why we fell in love, because neither of us wanted the kind of marriage that we'd seen modeled in our lives. And yet all of a sudden, when you have kids and like the model then became like, we started living that model. And and that was, you know, accidental, like neither of us had planned that. But there you have it. Like I quit my job as a journalist, like as full time, to work at home and to write full time. And as you alluded to before, journalism has changed so much that meant, you know, my salary took a massive hit with the devaluation of content and storytelling. And so all of a sudden it's like you're living this other model, and that dredged up a lot of sort of resentment and anger that I think didn't just belong to me. It was kind of my mother's and her mother's, you know, and kind of all of us living in this model of like, how are we to be as women? And so it took me a while to get through that. And looking back, I think, you know, I wish I'd let go of it sooner. But, you know, learning about Zen and studying Zen, really Zen, if you distill it down to one thing, it's just, you know, meeting the world as it is rather than as you want it to be. And that was such a great lesson for me, not only in healing my body from this accident and learning to run again, but really in being, you know, half of a marriage. Is like, we always, you know, it's really easy to want our partners to be different. The trick and the sort of enlightened way of living is to, you know, love and appreciate them for who they are. And so it took me a while. It took the time it did for me to kind of work through that. And I don't begrudge that time because I think, you know, everything takes the time it takes. But sometimes looking back, it's like, oh, I could have let go a little sooner. But spoiler alert, we're all good.
I was like revisiting your Instagram page before we hopped on here. Like, wait, they're still married, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. We are. You know, and it's like you kind of like have this fantasy, right? Like, oh, you know, I want the partner. My personal fantasy is I want the partner who's going to like sit in the coffee shop with me and like yak and read and talk and like while away the day at a coffee shop. You know, my husband makes coffee and the Mr. Coffee every morning for me before we get up. Like he is no more going to sit in a coffee shop with me and chat. But you know what? That's okay. Cause we do all these other things together. We're on rivers, mountains, you know, he cracks jokes like left, right, and center. So it's just, I think it's part of growing up is like learning to see the world as it is rather than like be holding on to this idea of how you want it to be.
Yeah. And I want to talk about the writing process involved in this, because you know, when you wrote Running Home about your father, your life, and the how those two mixed together and the influence he had on you, he had passed at that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're writing about Steve, he's very much alive.
Oh, he sure is. So, downstairs right now.
Right. So I remember I was reading Stephen A. Smith's book earlier this year. And his thing was like, some people asked me why it took me so long to write this book. And it was because I needed to write this book after my dad had passed. Mm-hmm. He had a very challenging relationship, or no, I'm sorry, after his mother had passed, because he had a very challenging relationship with his father. And his mom didn't want the pain of reading it because she knew that she would read his book and she didn't want to experience the pain of having to hear what he would say or what he would, you know, what he would write about that experience. So that's why he waited. So obviously that's not the case here, nor should it have been. You know, with that being said, what's that like for you? Because this process obviously is very different than the process you're writing about your father.
Oh, completely. Yeah. I mean, like I am, you know, married to my husband who's downstairs right now. And there were lots of times. Well, first of all, I just knew I had to tell the story. Like the story is a story with like these incredible bookends. And, you know, I've been a writer my whole life, but like you could just see that there was this story, this arc of a story. And so like, I don't ask for permission when I write. That's something I've learned early on is like our story. If we tell our story with compassion and truth, again, like not just factual truth, but sort of emotional truth, then that's the best we can do. Right. And I was never in a position where I thought I needed to ask permission from Steve to write the story, but I knew it would be painful. I mean, it was a painful chapter in our lives, and we both have a lot of regret about it. And so I started kind of tentatively, and I didn't talk about it a lot. And I mean, the good news is that Steve, like, he's so funny. And do you know the writer David Sedaris?
Yes, okay. I know David Sedaris.
And so, you know, he writes about his partner, his longtime husband, Hugh. And Hugh's always this sort of like witty kind of foil to David's like neurotic self. And Steve is my Hugh. Like he's just always there, solid, so funny, like never needs to be the center of attention. And so that said, like he doesn't read my work sometimes. You know, he read Running Home early, but I don't think he ever read the finished book. And I gave him a copy of Brief Flashings. And last I heard, which was like a week or so ago, he hadn't read it. And that's okay.
He's like, right? I was there the whole time.
And, you know, it took me a while to get over that and be like, you know, he doesn't, again, that's that fantasy, that coffee shop fantasy. Like I also had the fantasy, like my husband would be like, you know, lapping up every word I wrote. And you know what? He reads a ton, and it's okay that he hasn't read my book. And that took me a while to get through. And, but you know, it's tricky. It'll be interesting when it comes out. And, like we, you know, someone wanted to do a podcast with him. And I was like, I don't know, like, this is my story and I'm telling it. And of course he lived it, but you know, he shouldn't have to answer for what I've written. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. What I was envisioning was like him reading this would be kind of like if I'm aware that my wife is talking on the phone with her best friend and I'm the subject of the conversation, yeah. like I could hear what they're saying if I wanted to.
Right.
Or I could do the opposite. Right. I'm like, I'm left with this choice of like, what do I do? So I'm like, I could listen to this and this might be helpful. This might be cathartic, right? I might allow me to grow as a person, or I might just want to rehash every argument that we've already had over the last 2 weeks and give my side again for the 900th time.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know what? I'm leaving the room. I'm leaving the house. I'm just going to let them do their thing. And I'm going to act like this never happened.
That's proof that you're a sane person with like a grounded sensibility, right? And that's how I feel about Steve. Like, I think we live this together, this river accident, the aftermath, like the effect it had on us. And he's also like truly a Zen master. And he is not a religious or spiritual person. Like, he will tell you he's an atheist, but he is a Zen master in that he is so living in now. You know, he's not perseverating about the future or like angsting about the past. Like, he's just right here. And so in some ways, and I do write about this in Brief Flashings when like I'm kind of deep in learning about Zen and I kind of want like a Zen teacher. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, I have a Zen teacher. It's Steve, like all along this whole time. It's like right in front of me.
It reminded me so much of Parks and Rec when Ron Swanson goes to the meditation center. Uh-huh. Have you seen this episode?
No.
Oh my God. If you don't watch the show, it's fine. But it's like, if you ever want to like watch this like piece of episode, it's hysterical. So Rob Lowe is like the main like crazy character who like is trying to optimize and biohack everything. So takes Ron, who's, you know, to the meditation center. And then afterwards, he's like, you know, Rob Lowe's talking to him. He's like, hey, I couldn't believe it. Like, you just were there for 7 hours. You didn't even move. And they zoom in on like Ron Swanson afterwards. He goes, I don't know what all these fools are doing in there. This is the easiest. Like people ask me if like I know what Zen is. Like, no, I just sat there and I just stopped thinking. What the hell is everyone else's problem?
Yeah, yes, I mean,
this guy nails it.
It's like aggravating how Zen he is without even believing in Zen or like practicing Zen. Do you know what I mean? And so I say that with like total love because, you know, our greatest teachers are the people who also drive us crazy. And sometimes I just am like, you know, like he's never bothered about stuff. But actually check back in a few weeks when the book comes out. Hopefully my answer will be the same. But
I love that.
No, I do feel that I feel that ultimately it's a loving portrait. And I hope that readers see that I shoulder a lot of blame and like am turning the lens to myself as much as to sort of like the accident and how Steve handled things. Because, you know, I do feel like ultimately this is a love story about just the normal problems, the ordinary extreme problems that, you know, all marriages face, which is, you know, ours just happened to play out, you know, in the middle of the wilderness. Being married is like a long-term Zen practice, right? You just have to meet it as it is, right? Yourself and the other person and your union and the everyday mess downstairs, the dishes in the sink.
Yeah, yeah. There's no question about that. And I think part of the reason I loved this book was almost like the voyeuristic nature of it for me, of like, I love professional athletes. Mm-hmm. I love following what they do. I love like everything about them. Like, I can still recall the earliest days of watching like sports documentaries. Mm-hmm. Like, we didn't call them that at the time, but like that genre. Mm-hmm. And like, I've always loved that. But I love part of this because like, I had to keep reminding myself, like, Katie Arnold wins Leadville.
Yeah.
Like, she didn't just get into the race on a whim and a prayer and here goes nothing with like a devil may care approach to training. Like, she wins this race. It's like this insane thing. It's like, I'd keep reminding myself because it does feel the whole story. While like, I've never been on a river, I've never done anything that you detail in this book, but it feels so digestible from a human perspective that I have to keep reminding myself, this is one of the best runners in the country talking like this.
Yeah.
And I loved that part of it because it does humanize, like, you know, like the, what does a professional runner do in a day kind of vibe. It's like, well, this is it. We're watching, like, this is it right here. And I found it to be incredibly interesting. I love how you talked about Steve there, about, like, he just does this and it's like, it's effortless in its own way. It's like incomprehensible, the Zen aspect of it, because it's funny. I think this is a great way of explaining probably how the rest of us feel about you and your running. Because because, like, how you approach your running, like, I don't care about, like, the competition part of it. I just go and I run, and it kind of flows. I've just been doing it for as long as I've been conscious of doing it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the results are the results. And we're sitting here like, dude, you won the race. Like, this is insane. Like, we look at you, like, in that same vibe as, like, when you look at Steve as the Zen master.
When I'm like, how is he? And I marvel about that. In the book a lot, I'm like, how is he the way he is? Like, he's just got these crazy one-liners that, like, pop out of his brain, and you're just like, his timing is impeccable. Yeah, you're right. Maybe that's how people think of me. I don't know. I
guarantee you it is, because I've actually talked to people about this one, because it's that same vibe of, like, I just go out, I do my daily run, and the results are the results. And someone's like, oh, what are the results? It's like, oh, I win.
Yeah. I mean, but still, like, I do think back on Leadville, and like, that really was running with this beginner's mind and the Zen mind of, like, and just to demystify it for people, Zen, like, I am not, like, a Buddhist capital B, you know, like, I am a skeptic, but I, Zen really resonates with me because it is about releasing this idea of results and of knowing what you're doing, of kind of controlling situations. And it's really, you know, it's letting go and being in the moment, which sounds so trite, but it actually is always how I've run, right? Which is like, I kind of enter races, or before I became competitive, I would enter races sort of haphazardly, and I would, like, sort of train or sort of not, and then, like, never think about the result and then have a good result. And so I think it was like finding Zen was like finding kind of just my guidebook for life that I'd been living already without knowing it. And so everything made sense to me. And I write about this in the book, that, like, a friend of mine who's a very deeply wise Zen practitioner and writer, she gave me this book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which then became kind of my Bible, for lack of a better word, for healing. And as I read the book, I realized it didn't just apply to running. It applied to writing, to love, to life, to parenting. And I felt as though I'd stumbled upon these secret instructions on how to live. And I still stand by that. Like, and my friend Natalie, when she gave me the book, was like, you know, you may, this is one of my favorite moments in the book. She's like, you know, you're probably not going to understand it. And Natalie's in her 70s, and she's like a straight talker. She has, like, her leftover Long Island accent, you know, and she's like, you're probably not going to understand it. And I knew she didn't mean it personally, like my intellect wasn't up to the task, but more that the book is very, it's pretty eccentric. It's hard to understand in places. It's written by this Japanese Zen master in the, you know, early 1970s, when Zen was kind of just becoming big in this country. And English was his second language. Well, as soon as I started reading the book, it was like he was inside my brain. I understood it perfectly. And I didn't understand it with my mind or my brain or my rational thinking, but I understood it with my body. And it was because I had this running practice already, and because I have this writing practice. And so it was just eerie. It was like he was speaking directly to me, that we were, like, separated at birth or something. And so that became this journey into Zen, of trying to understand how to live. And I don't really, again, I don't think of it as a religious thing. Like, anyone listening, you don't have to be religious at all. You could be religious in a different way. Like, you know, my friend Natalie was raised Jewish. Like, I'm, you know, I was raised Christian. You don't have to have any kind of religious ideas, but it really does, I think, contain, like, every secret to being alive right now.
And I love how you write about it. And at the same time, I couldn't help myself from wondering throughout the book, because I had read your first book and because I had talked to you before, the juxtaposition, to use that word again, between how you naturally approached your running, mm-hmm. with this same framework or through this same lens, but that it didn't apply itself to the rest of your life. Like you talk, and this isn't my opinion, you say in the book many times that like you and Steve always have this wrestling for control, and that control is this main element, whereas control is something that you seemingly effortless let go of in running.
Right.
But yet at the same time, not in the other aspects of your life. Looking back on it now, that especially that you've gone through the Zen process here and made that practice part of your life, why do you think that it didn't naturally get absorbed into your non-athletic life?
Like before I really sort of explored Zen in a deeper way?
Correct.
I think because like, you know, it's human nature to sort of want to know how things are going to work and to have control. And we live in a culture where we, knowledge is prized. Like everyone wants to know the hacks, the shortcuts, like the results, you know, we want to optimize everything. And so just living in that world, like it's easy to want certain things to be a certain way. And then if you're an ambitious person like me, and you know, it's just, you get caught up in sort of having it be the way you want it to be. And it really took this, you know, dramatic fracture, I mean, for lack of a better word, in my life to wake me up to the fact that like, and I've learned this when my dad died, but this was a relearning on a deeper level, that we're not in control, right? That anything can happen at any time. And that actually, and this is one of my biggest, the things I love most about Zen, it is prizes not knowing, right? It prizes this sort of like open mind of like, I don't know what's going to happen. And that is such a relief as like a competitive runner for starters. Like you go into a race, especially an ultra marathon or any kind of trail race where there's so many variables, you know, weather, terrain, altitude, whatnot, that to just let go and be like, beats me, I don't know what's going to happen, is such a relief. Because, you know, and my philosophy has always been like prepare, prepare, prepare. And then if you show up prepared on race day, you can just let go and let whatever is going to happen, happen. And so it took this accident for me to start to apply that to marriage of like, I wanted to always know how it was going to be for Steve and me. And I think that's being a child of divorce, frankly. It's like you want the certainty. You want to know. And at the first sign of trouble, you're like, I don't know. Am I out of here? Like, it's scary, that turbulence. And it's normal. Like any relationship will have that. And so it just took this really, traumatic experience for me to understand like the same things, the way I approach my running, I should approach love and marriage, which is like, I don't know, but I'm here and I'm going to try my best.
Well, you got there. That's for sure. I can't recommend this book strongly enough. It comes out April 16th. Everyone should go pick it up. That is for sure. Before we get going, Katie, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about the boom in the trail and ultra world in your neck of the woods. Aravaipa seemingly has just, I mean, made in an unbelievable, I shouldn't say seemingly, has made an indelible mark on the trail and ultra world. I think they have 33 races now, with most of them in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. It's incredible to witness from afar. I live in Rhode Island. What's it like for you being there the whole time and seeing the growth in the regional racing of the Southwest?
I mean, it's super inspiring, and they do such a fantastic job. I've only raced a couple of their races, the McDowell Mountain Frenzy. I did the 50-mile, and then I did the Black Canyon. But they're phenomenal. I will say that New Mexico still is this, like, little bubble that, like, you know, when the weatherman comes on the TV, I mean, not that anyone watches that anymore, but they always stand in front of New Mexico and they're like, in Arizona, this is happening. And in Texas, this is happening. But they're like physically blocking the state of New Mexico. I feel like that's still New Mexico. Like we're in a different time warp, which actually suits me fine because I like the low key vibe. I like being under the radar. That's always how I've been as a runner. It's why I love to live here as a writer, because I'm out of that sort of New York like literary world. So the randomness suits me, but it is pretty inspiring to see what's going on, like to, you know, on our immediate, you know, east and west of us. And there's so many trails in New Mexico, like, and there's so few people. So that is, I think, how, you know, we're so lucky to live here. And I did have a moment a few years ago where I was like really wrestling with traveling to race, Just from an environmental standpoint and kind of like the sustainability factor and having to.
Had you just read Damien Hall's book? Was that the impetus?
No, the impetus was like just in me, like, oh, like, I don't know if this feels right anymore. And I really wrestled because I was like, I mean, I could go out my door and run a 50K, you know, without like getting in a car and through beautiful landscapes. So I think that's something that, you know, ultra runners, we will need to look at, you know, more directly, because even with the boom of races and we're all traveling and, you know, there's lottery races that are impossible to get into. Like, I just think I'd be remiss if I didn't encourage people to just like run where they are too. And I mean that on different levels. I mean, run in your own body, in whatever's wrong, in a Zen way. Like, if your knee's hurting, run with that. If your heart is unsure about if you're committed, run with that. But also just like run where you live. Like, it's, you know, nothing better than making a relationship with your natural habitat right outside your door.
No question about that. And I guess I would say, as not a rejoinder, but I would add on to, like, you know, if you're going to travel for something, make the most of it.
Yeah.
You know, definitely. Don't just travel, you know, for some like superfluous thing or get like the JV version of the experience.
Right. You know? Yeah, make it worth it, and then maybe offset your travel a little too.
There you go. All right, Katie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks,
it was
Matt.
An absolute pleasure to talk to you. All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Rambling Runner Podcast. Go check out ASICS, our presenting sponsor, at ASICS.com today. Also, are you in the market for a coach? I don't know if you know this. I am a coach, so I've been working with amateur runners for over 5 years now as part of McCurdy Trained, the biggest run coaching service in America, and I love doing it. It really is one of the highlights of my day. I love working with amateur athletes who are working to get better and balancing running with a crazy schedule or looking to get the most out of their running. They feel like you have potential, but you're just not sure what to do. That's exactly where I can step in. Also, for people who maybe need just someone to like be accountable to. That's a big one. That's one for me. That's why I like having a running coach, someone I can be accountable to. Also, a lot of athletes that I work with are kind of maybe on the type A end of the spectrum, and it's great for them to have a counterbalance. And I think that that's something that I can provide for them as someone who can allow them to just relax, enjoy their running, and not obsess over it. So if that is something that you're interested in, you can always email me at ramblingrunnerpodcast@gmail.com, or you can always shoot me a message on Instagram, rambling_runner. Thank you so much for listening, and happy running.